out. Always good to see you here. I just want to let you know that Jaywalk is in the back somewhere. Oh, yeah, they're right there. If you would like to buy some cool apparel, some baseball-themed apparel, you know, local companies, support your local businesses, very important. So go check them out. Later in the show, we're going to have Jeff Blair up. We're going to have Gord Ash. But before those two, Mike Sont is here.
Thanks.
You know him from Baseball Prospectus, from Fangraphs, from the Day Games podcast. He's an ergonomist?
It's close.
Something like
ergonomist.
That? Ergonomist.
Yeah.
And so you study the way that people work.
I do.
And you study the way that pitchers work, especially.
Yes.
And that's a pretty timely topic with your Toronto Blue Jays right now, as we're looking at a situation right now with Marcus Stroman experiencing some armpit tightness. You might have 60% of this pitching staff on the disabled list. That is a very real possibility. After last year, the Blue Jays used only 7 starting pitchers. Could you have seen this coming, Mike, that after they used so few starting pitchers last year, they were just due for some injuries?
Kind of on the negative side of me, you kind of think pitchers get hurt. It's an extremely demanding task that they're doing. There's so much effort that's put into every pitch, and the injury rate, it's like something like 40% of pitchers in a season will get hurt. They'll end up on the disabled list. So you kind of think the numbers will eventually work out against them. So things went so well last year that you kind of felt that you know, year-to-year randomization, it was going to come back and get them. But the fact that you've got guys who have been relatively healthy all dropping out, like Stroman and Happ, it is definitely a shock to the system to see it happen.
You've done some work on pitchers that are actually more susceptible to injury, or pitchers that are more likely to get injured. How can you predict something like that? What are some of the factors that you look at?
So when we're looking at like the risk factors for a pitcher getting hurt, there was a really good paper done by some researchers out of the University of Michigan, and they found there were like 6 main factors that could predict if somebody would have an elbow injury. And they were pitchers who threw harder, so higher velocity, pitchers who were shorter, pitchers who had a more upright release point, pitchers who threw more pitches in a game, and then pitchers who had fewer days rest between their appearances. So relievers and starters, but condensed there. So I've kind of tried to look at the Jays staff like that, and the one guy who keeps coming up, and I kind of came up with a workload metric called the fatigue units, it was Roberto Osuna. And just, he keeps coming up at the top of the list.
What are some of the reasons for that?
He throws really hard. He throws primarily like that fastball. Particularly last year. This year he's kind of switched it up. Yeah, which, I mean, and it was a good fastball too. So that's, I mean, you get rewarded when it's something good like that. The big factor was how bad everyone was at the start of last season. Remember, like, Jesse Chavez was getting rocked.
And Drew Storen,
who's awesome now, apparently. He's, like, really good this year, apparently. So thanks for that, Drew.
It's relievers, man. Relievers are the small sample of small samples.
Exactly. So things like that. At age 21, there'd never been somebody who had a higher workload from this perspective than Roberto Osuna. So he's been good in a bullpen that's been inconsistent, and over the past few years, he's been the one that they've looked to get those outs on a very regular basis.
You mentioned shorter pitchers. There's one of those on the Toronto Blue Jays. His first name's Marcus. He's rather short.
Height does measure injury susceptibility.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah.
The shortest pitcher in the majors, and he just came out of his start. That was last night, I guess, with this armpit thing. We don't know exactly what's going on with him. It's folly to speculate, but what is it about a shorter pitcher? Because I would think, like, just, I don't know, like, more compact, maybe there's less moving parts, there's less muscle to injure, but you would say it's more likely that a shorter pitcher is going to get hurt.
If you look at Marcus's dad, though, there's a lot more tissue genetically.
Yes.
Big girl. So when you see somebody who is stronger, or sorry, shorter, what they're going to have to rely on is generating that force, whereas you have the exact opposite in Aaron Sanchez, where when he throws, he's just using those long levers, those long arms, those long legs to generate that velocity, where Stroman's really got to put a lot more effort into it. So I think that's part of the reason why you'd see a shorter pitcher possibly be more susceptible to an injury. The one thing that Stroman had going for him that, you know, I had in the drafts, I'm sure you've done this before, put a whole thing about how effective he was and how he was really reducing his workload because he just had so few pitches per inning. Looking at this workload metric, he was near the top in all of Major League Baseball in innings pitched, but he was in like the middle for this workload because he just keeps so few pitches per inning. And then all of a sudden he gets hurt in that last start. So some of those other risk factors kind of flared up, unfortunately.
You mentioned Aaron Sanchez in there, and you know Aaron Sanchez is dealing with somewhat of a traditional pitcher injury, blisters. Pitchers deal with blisters all the time. Some guys can pitch through them. Some guys don't. Some guys have their careers like stalled by them. You look at Rich Hill last year and what he went through. What have you kind of looked into with blisters and pitchers and what's going on there?
So I think it was about 3 weeks ago, did a piece on Rotographs about Rich Hill and his blister problems. And if you look at the list of high spin rate pitchers, Rich Hill is up there, Seth Lugo is up there, and Aaron Sanchez is up there for their curveballs. And all three of those guys have had blister issues. If you look at like how a pitcher generates spin, particularly on a curveball, there's just so much friction that happens underneath their fingertip. And having high levels of friction, particularly, you know, once somebody gets warmed up and is pitching, their body temperature is up, it generates more friction, it increases that risk of having a blister. And, you know, whenever somebody announces that a pitcher is missing a start because of a blister, you see people on Twitter like, oh, toughen up, I had a blister one time and I still played beer league softball. but the problem is, it's not that they can't pitch through the pain. Like, they physically cannot do it. Like, he can't get any command on his curveball. He can't feel his release point. So he's either going to get shelled or he's going to walk a million guys. So it's not that he can't tough it out. It's that he physically cannot pitch at a major league level when that happens.
It's a fine line between leaving a curveball over the plate and really burying it and having the deception to it where it looks like it's going to be over the plate and then it just plummets right down like Aaron Sanchez's does.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the advantages that Sanchez has is his ability to release at such a high point and have that 96-mile-an-hour fastball and then work off with, like, a 74-mile-an-hour curveball. It's always weird when, like, the fans turn off and all of a sudden you hear yourself a lot more. so, yeah, Sanchez derives a lot of his effectiveness from having that real high-spin curveball that is, it's slow with respect to his fastball. It moves a ton. And if he can't do that, then he's really ineffective. And he also increases his risk of hurting something else. And I think he mentioned something in an interview. He could only pitch for so long in a certain way that jeopardized other parts of his body to favor this blister.
Well, yeah, because you start compensating for it, right? And you start trying to use other parts of your body to generate that torque and generate that momentum, I guess.
Yeah, he's probably doing something so that he changes his release points so that he doesn't have the friction right on the point where that blister was, and as a result, you know, he's going to put his elbow at a higher risk of injury. And I mean, you can miss 20 days with a blister, or you can miss 16 months with a Tommy John. So this is a good trade off.
Yeah, I guess so. If you're going from the worst possible injury. But, you know, you said 40% of pitchers are going to get hurt. To me, that's almost low. Like, I'm surprised more guys don't get hurt, considering how unnatural of a thing it is to, every 5 days, throw, like, this little sphere 100 times at 90-plus miles an hour. I feel like the human body isn't constructed, designed, whatever, to do that.
Not at all. And that's in a season. Over the course of a career, that number's way higher. Like, somebody's going to get hurt at some point in time doing a baseball pitch. Like, it's really quite difficult on the human body. And it's funny you mentioned, like, the every 5 days thing. And that study looked at, you know, shorter time between appearances was actually a risk factor. And I've talked to some friends in the research community and what they think is happening. And if you look at the incidence of Tommy John surgery in relievers versus starters, it happens like 3 times more in relievers compared to starters. So remember how like it was all like, let's move Sanchez to the bullpen.
Yes.
First of all, like imagine you move Sanchez to the bullpen or shut him down last year so that he could live through this year. But what you're seeing like is that a reliever doesn't necessarily know when he's going to pitch, right? He goes to the ballpark that day. They may say, okay, get up. So he gets warm. He starts throwing. And then they say, okay, nope, we don't need you this inning. So he sits back down. Then he gets warm again. And then he does actually go in. And then the next day he, you know, does his pregame routine. He gets warmed up again. And this game he doesn't go in. But then sometimes you'll see a guy like go in like 3 days in a row. And what you're seeing there is like there's just so much variability in when they're going that their body doesn't necessarily have the chance to like adapt and recover. There's another research study that looked at like their risk of injury with respect to their heart rate variability. It's a whole phenomenon that's still kind of being studied. But they found that in pitchers, their heart rate variability was a lot lower the day after they pitched. So if you're going back to back to back, and we've shown that this heart rate variability being lower is a sign that somebody might get hurt, you can see how dangerous it would be for a reliever to go back to back to back. And that's what you're seeing with somebody like poor Osuna when nobody else can get an out aside from him and be a genie. It really does elevate his chance of risk. And this year, you know, when he started on the DL, I'm like, okay, here we go. You know, that is something. Moving to the bullpen is not a reprieve from the demands of pitching. It's just a different type of demand, which is just as harmful.
Well, and that's where you bump up also against the need to win games. Wins and losses. You're in the major leagues, and if you're the only guy who's getting outs, and if you're a major league manager and you're saying, this is Roberto Osuna is the only guy I trust, I know he threw 20 pitches the day before, I got to go back to him because I got to win this game because maybe I don't have my job next week if we don't win it. And with each pitcher, there is kind of a different sweet spot of how much recovery they need because every human is a beautiful snowflake and we're all different and we all need different, you know what I mean? Some guys recover quicker. Like R.A. Dickey used to say he could pitch every day. Like, I'm fine. I don't even have a UCL. I'm good. Yeah. But with Roberto Osuna, a guy who is a pretty effortful pitcher, a guy who throws with the inverted W. If you ever see that photo of him in his delivery, you'll see his elbows are pointed up skyward, and a lot of people look at that as a sign of somebody who
a lot of wrong people.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Inverted W has no relationship to injury. There are some timing flaws, somebody rotating their torso too early when they're releasing a pitch, but research has shown that inverted W is a bit of a boogeyman.
Really?
It doesn't actually exist as a risk factor.
So do you think that was just because a lot of pitchers had gotten Tommy John and people had seen that they were pitching with that? It was kind of like a correlation rather than causation type of thing?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. There's nothing that shows that, you know, if you take two pitchers who throw at the same velocity, one has an inverted W and the other does have the inverted W, there's no increase in injury risk with the inverted W group.
That is interesting.
Yep.
So I would think that mechanically you would be putting more stress by going like this, right? Like you can even feel it when you just do it yourself.
Yeah, without a doubt. But it was a paper by a physician who used to be the Washington Nationals team physician. And if you're ever on Twitter and you see somebody called the pain guy come up, Chris O'Leary, he's a total crackpot. But he has he's been the one that's been saying everything is inverted W, everybody's going to get hurt, that's on my list, pay $30 a month to visit my site, I'm a jackass. Sorry, milk crate there for a second. There's nothing that says inverted W is a risk factor. But there are definitely things, pitchers who are rotating early and as a result are having to just rely on all their soft tissues and their ligaments to generate that velocity as they come through, that's something that would be a definite concern.
Interesting. What about velocity? Like, how much of a difference would there be for a pitcher, say, who, like, Marco Estrada throws 89, 90, Aaron Sanchez throws 96, 97. What's the difference in likelihood of injury between those two guys?
Unfortunately, the high-velocity guys are at a higher risk of injury, and it makes a lot of sense because there's just more torque on those ligaments in your arm. But at the same time, if you look at like ERA or FIP versus velocity, that's also a pretty strong relationship. Guys who throw harder have a lot higher chance of having success and probably a lot higher chance of having a career as a pitcher in Major League Baseball. And somebody like Marco Estrada is probably the exception and not the, oh, well, you know, he's doing that, or Greg Maddux threw this hard, or Kyle Hendricks did this hard. Like, look what's happening to Kyle Hendricks this year.
Yeah.
He's getting shelled, right? Velocity is an insurance policy for a pitcher. Like, if you miss your spot at 95 down the middle, it may get crushed. But if you miss your spot at 89 down the middle, it's probably going to get crushed.
It will get crushed.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you hear somebody like Noah Syndergaard come into this year saying, I worked out all off season, I put on 15 pounds of muscle, I'm going to try to throw harder. I had one of the hardest fastballs in the major leagues last year. Like, it was like 96, 97 in average. I want to go up to 98, 99. What goes through your head when you hear a guy saying stuff like that?
Well, first, when he's adding muscle, you think when he adds muscle, he's hopefully adding muscle in throughout his entire body. So he's, one, generating that velocity with a lot less effort, and two, that he's also building muscle in his forearm, in his bicep, in those muscles that can actually take some of the torque off of his ulnar collateral ligament. So in that case, he's probably going to do some work to protect his elbow. At the same time, it is a pretty significant relationship with injury risk and velocity. You throw harder, you have a higher risk of injury. But then it's like the third dimension is, yeah, but you also strike fools out. And when you when you're striking fools out, you know what else? You get paid. So there's a lot more guys that throw 97 and stay in the league for 6 years and make a nice salary than guys who throw 90 and are bouncing between AAA and the majors. Like, huge example of that, Mike Bolsinger. He has like a track record of being a very decent major league starting pitcher. Not great. He's not going to win a Cy Young or anything like that. But like he played pretty well with the Dodgers, what, 2-3 years ago?
Sure.
And he's in the Jays AAA system. But so many other guys, like, I mean, you look at Joe Kelly, who's got the best stuff in the entire universe, and like a 5.5 ERA or whatever it is, and he doesn't strike a lot of guys out, but he gets those opportunities because they know that velocity gives him a better chance to succeed.
Interesting. Does anybody have a question for Dr. Mike Son about any of this stuff? I see one in the back there who's walking up to the mic.
The Blue Jays have a side armor for the first time in a long time.
Joe Smith?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what does that do? I look at the way he pitches, and I see a bent elbow, and I'm going, man, that's going to hurt him. What does, when you're throwing, as they say, from down under, what does that do to the pitch?
It puts a lot of stress on his shoulder and on his elbow. And if he threw 97, then you'd be really, really concerned about it. But he does throw, what, 88, 89?
Yeah, he's like around there, 89, yeah. 90.
So
it would be hard to throw 97 from a low arm angle, I think.
Yeah, especially without like your forearm actually detaching from your body and then forming a second obstruction to the batter as he was trying to hit the ball.
Aaron Loop's got kind of like a three quarters, and he can get up to 94, 95.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, how much time has he spent on the DL, right? So it does put a lot more stress on them. It also puts a lot more stress on the hitter because it's coming from a release point that they have a hard time with. And when you do throw with a more sidearm action, you do see a lot more movement as well. So it can be used as a technique to get pitchers out, but you definitely wouldn't want to see too many starters throwing sidearm.
Thanks. That was my next question, which is, what is the advantage of throwing sidearm?
A lot more movement. And you'll actually see, like, if you watch, like, a Clayton Kershaw start, he'll throw very much over the top, and then he'll drop down and throw his fastball, like, at a sidearm angle every now and then just to totally, like, mess with the hitters.
That's crazy when one pitcher can work from different arm angles. Because you think about so many pitchers, their success is dependent on repeating that release point. And coming from the same arm angle, they try to do things exactly the same each time. I want to have the same amount of time between pitches. I want to start my delivery at the same point. I want to keep my rhythm and momentum going. So when you see guys who can do that, or even what Marcus Stroman does on the mound, where he'll pause in the middle of his delivery, or he'll, you know.
And Johnny Cueto, too.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That kind of stuff is crazy.
Yeah.
That you can still have location, because we always kind of overestimate how much command pitchers have. Like, a lot of
hugely.
Times. Right?
Like, hugely.
They're just trying to get somewhere near the plate, you know? Like, they don't know. It's not, like, a precise thing.
Well, like, I mean, like, 1 degree of a difference with your wrist position at 60 feet 6 inches could mean, like, 4 feet, right? Like, so they're not as precise. They're not throwing it through a bullseye, that's for sure.
Just watch the catchers. Next time you watch a game, watch where the catcher sets up and then where he catches the ball. And it's very, very rarely does a catcher set up and just go like that. It's very often that they're all over.
There's like a system in Major League Baseball called, I think it's CatchFX, but the data is not publicly available. But they can actually use, or CommandFX is what it's called, and they can actually track where the catcher sets up and where the ball ends up. And I know the year that Dallas Keuchel won the Cy Young, he missed this spot on average by 12 inches.
Wow. Yeah. My friend.
I just got one quick question to you, or two quick questions. One about Joe Jamie, another about, have you heard of Michael Kolpak, and what's your thoughts about him?
You know, have you heard of Michael Kolpak is the question, and what are your thoughts on him?
And Joe Biagini.
Yeah.
Michael Kolpak,
well,
from the White Sox?
Yeah.
Formerly from the... He has the stuff to be a starter. He's got all the different pitches.
He's got the body to be a starter.
Yeah.
He does.
Yeah.
He's like 6'5", 240. Like,
yeah.
He's got the body to be a starter.
Yeah. He's got the personality to be a goalie, too. Yeah. I mean, if you look at injury incidence rates, like I was saying about starters versus relievers, I love watching him pitch. So I'd like to see him be a starter so that he can stick around for a little bit longer.
It's so grim.
Yeah. No, I know.
So he's the next guy we should be watching you think about the high workload, you think about
yeah.
the injury risk.
Well, remember how
you
they
got
were
your
like,
eye
oh,
on Mr.
Sanchez
Biagini.
Has had a huge workload increase last year. It was so
yeah.
devastating. Biagini had an astronomical workload increase.
Did he, though? Didn't he come from being a starter with the
he
Giants
came,
in Double
he
A?
He came, but like I guess I'm biased. It's from, like, looking at it from this other workload metric perspective
right.
where relievers get a little bit more weighting based off of
right.
how many days of rest they have. And he was through the roof with his increase. So he, you know, I'd like to see him be a starter. I'd like to see him get an opportunity to start a few games. Otherwise, I mean, it's funny how he doesn't get mentioned in the same breath with, like, Dellin Betances or Andrew Miller, because he's been pretty damn effective.
Yeah, his numbers haven't been quite to that level.
Not to that extreme level, that's for sure.
He doesn't strike out guys as often as those
yeah.
two do, which I think might be part of the reason why.
For
but
sure, yeah.
Yeah, no, if you're in a bases loaded jam and you need a ground ball,
yep.
Joe Biagini is probably the best guy in that bullpen to go to.
Definitely. And as for Michael Kolpak, he's like the next Chapman type guy who's just a complete freak who can throw like 106. I think, didn't he hit like 108 or something? Like, absolutely.
That ain't right.
It was like in minor league baseball. It was absolutely insane. Like,
well, they changed the way they read it, right?
Yeah.
They used to read it once the ball had left the hand, and now they're reading it from the point of release.
Yeah.
So you have that less wind, that air resistance is taken away.
Yeah. Well, they were reading it like at like a set distance, right? At like 50 feet or 55 feet or something.
Yeah.
And now the TrackMan is like as soon as the ball is released. So that changed everything. It screwed up the whole like stuff metric stuff that I was doing. It was totally
your poor metrics.
Yeah. My metrics. No.
Say anything on Kolpak?
He just, like, he throws so damn hard. You see that as, like, being a possible risk factor. But at the same time, you look at somebody like Chapman, who really hasn't had an injury history, and you kind of say, maybe this guy is just an absolute freak and is going to withstand it. Because you look at all the other injury risk factors, and Chris Sale should have been, like lost his arm
right.
a long time ago, and he's still going. So sometimes you're just getting into such a component of the population that are just such freaks that your traditional way of looking at injury just doesn't apply anymore.
Some of it's got to be genetic, right? Like some of
100%. Yeah. You know? Definitely it is.
What do you think about how a guy like Sale can hold up? And it doesn't look like there is a, you know, a fiber of muscle on his body. He is so slender and skinny. And then you've got some pitchers, you know, guys like David Wells, you know, or you know, and some of those guys, you know, had some help from synthetic substances. But they, you know, some of these larger pitchers who threw really, really well and really, really hard for a lot of innings and were fine as well. Totally different body types.
That's just genetics. Some people are just built for it, I guess. And when people say, you know, there's perfect pitching mechanics or something like that, there's no such thing as perfect pitching mechanics, because the way Chris Sale throws that ball and prevents himself from being hurt, I mean, that's perfect for what his body does. You look at right at like the muscle level, people's muscles insert at different angles into their bone. So if you were to say everybody needs to have the same mechanics, you're going to have some people who are great, and then other people who totally get hurt and can't generate any velocity. So it's there's more that we don't know about pitching than there is that we do know.
As with all things in life, Mike. Anyone else got something for Mike Son? Yeah.
Just a quick question from your science background. So with all these recent like lat or armpit injuries, do you think the boys like Thor or Strowman are throwing on maybe a little too much deodorant? It's getting a little too sticky and throwing on mechanics?
Who let that guy have a question? Yeah.
I did.
Maybe they're doing too much of that like armpit fart sound stuff. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Anyone else? That joke went over great. Anyone else?
He's one of my fellow fake doctors.
Well, tell us about your podcast, Mike. You guys still doing the Day Games podcast?
Yeah. So we did the first season of Day Games. It was a podcast that looked at people who work in baseball. So we looked at kind of just a day in the life of people who made maple bats. We looked at the Blue Jays Spanish language translator,
Josue
Pelé, who throws like batting practice and like does everything.
Sometimes he'll like help warm up the pitchers between innings.
I was talking to him and I said to him, like, you realize like the skill set you have is probably like there's fewer people on planet Earth that have your skill set than like can do brain surgery. Like,
well, he's not a translator who also like pitches. He's a ball player who just happens to be bilingual.
Yeah.
Trilingual, actually. He speaks French too.
Yeah, I know. He's unbelievable. And then we had Kyle Bodie, who's from Driveline Baseball out in Seattle, who popularized weighted balls. Eno Saris, who was like the head writer from FanGraphs. So it's a podcast that just kind of gives you an idea of what people do to pay their bills while working in baseball and not necessarily playing baseball.
Check that out on iTunes. Check him out at Baseball Perspectives at FanGraphs. It's Mike Son. Everybody, give him a hand.
Thanks.
We take a quick break to let you all refill your beverages, and then in a few minutes we'll have Jeff Blair
right?
and Gordash. Please, you deserve it.
Thanks.
If you enjoy this show, you can go to homestandsports.com, where there's a bunch of shows going on this summer, and not just baseball. You've got football, both kinds of football, the one actually with your feet, and the one where you don't use your feet that much. Basketball talks, all kinds of stuff. Jaywalk is in the back. Mike Wilner sends his apologies. Boo. He sends his apologies. He had to go on to St. Petersburg with the Blue Jays because Jerry Howarth is ill. So Mike has to call the games on the Fan 590, so he wasn't able to be here. It's a fine excuse. Blair is skeptical.
He had a day off. He could have still made it.
Yeah, right? He could have come back and gone back, right? But anyway, these two...
Wilner's in Florida. He's not missing us, believe me.
But Wilner's not enjoying Florida. You know that he's got like a 12-pack of Fanta and sitting in his hotel room doing nothing. We all know that. That's Jeff Blair. That you know him from the Jeff Blair Show, from Baseball Central, from Sportsnet's baseball coverage, man of many mediums. And that's Gord Ash. He is a member of the Milwaukee Brewers front office, former general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. And hey, we've got a member of the Milwaukee Brewers front office here right now. Eric Thames is probably right now hitting four or five dingers in a game. He's had an incredible start to the year. You guys scouted him purely on video, brought him in, made kind of what some people would say was kind of a risk-reward offer. Reward so far. What can you say about Eric Thames and what he's done so far?
Well, certainly he's been tremendous, and I think the biggest difference in him is his ability to swing at strikes now. I mean, he's very, very patient at the plate. He credits his time in Korea with allowing him to see more breaking balls, which obviously it's a breaking ball league. But what that did is trained his eye to make sure that he was swinging at strikes. And when you look at the numbers right now, that bears it out that he's swinging at strikes, and when he makes contact, they go a long way. Now, I know there's been a lot of speculation about his how he's gotten that strength, and he's been tested a number of times already. But when you look, I know the whole PED thing has changed through the years, where at one time, if you were an immense size, then obviously that was your immediate telltale sign. But, you know, he physically he looks a little stronger, but about the same physically. So, you know, it's you're right. It was a risk because, trying to extrapolate stats from the Korean League, you know, most people rated it as a high AA, fringe AAA type league. So it is a tough evaluation process. But, you know, our guys worked on it for about a year, and they went that extra year on the contract, and that probably was the difference.
This is sort of gambles or risks that you take as a small market franchise that are kind of more up your alley than another's?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You have to do that because there's only so many ways you can get players. You know, through the draft, obviously, we have a fair shake there. But internationally, it'll be a little different now with the balancing of the signing pools. But, you know, at one time, a few years ago, we didn't have the kind of resources that the Yankees or other clubs would have to sign all of the Latin players, so we were behind in that market. And then when it came to free agency, of course, we're lower down the list of desirable cities, and of course, not as much revenue to pay these players. So these are the kind of risks that you have to take, and you give other fringe players opportunities. Guy Carlos Torres is, for instance, not a big name, but he's played a very valuable role in the bullpen. He released player last year from the Mets and stepped in and did a nice job in our bullpen. Not quite as effective this year. But, you know, those are the kind of guys you have to look out to round your team if you can.
Gord, from your time with the Jays and with the Brewers, I mean, we've seen guys go to Japan or Korea, and they have okay careers. They kind of finish out their career, make a little bit of money. But this is a guy who went over there, came back, and has reestablished himself in the majors. Is there a certain type of personality that meshes better with playing baseball in Korea and Japan and makes it more likely that that guy will end up coming back here?
Yeah, absolutely.
Playing the majors.
Yes, Jeff, absolutely. I think there are players that expect to go to these countries. And the enticement, of course, is the fact if they've been a fringy major leaguer or a veteran minor leaguer and they're not made a lot of money, the opportunity to make some real money, especially in Japan, but to some extent now in Korea, is what the enticement is, and players will go there and expect it to be just like home, which, of mm-hmm. course, it isn't. So if you're an open-minded kind of individual and you're somebody that will accept the non-traditional approaches that both countries have towards training and the way they get ready for games, then you have a chance at success. And, you know, the interesting thing is that there's a number of Latin players that have gone to Japan and have had real success because I don't think to them it mattered so much mm-hmm. what the culture was. They already made that one transition from Latin America to the U.S. to make another transition. Wasn't that big a deal. So open-mindedness, I think, and there's been some other talented players that go there and just hate it because it is not what they expected or the way they want to work.
Vladimir Ballantyne has set records over there.
He sure has, and you know, it's the same game, obviously, but it's slightly different. It's a little more cloak and dagger. There's a lot of, there's not much information. There's a rule that you have to post your next day's lineup, but what they do is just take yesterday's lineup and post it again because they don't want anybody to know who's going to play that next game. And I'm not sure this is a strategic thing or just a space thing, but the bullpens in in the, at least in the Tokyo Stadium, which is the only one that I've been to, are hidden. You don't know who's warming up.
Right.
So that's an interesting part as well. A lot of singing. You get that soccer feel at the ballpark. So it's a fun experience. Anybody gets a chance to go, you should go.
I don't know how much you want to reveal, but do you know how much competition there was in the bidding for Eric Thames? How many teams you're up against?
There were a number of clubs, Arden, that had interest in him. But you know, most of that was just on either a minor league deal or a one-year major league deal. A couple of clubs talked about a two-year deal. We were the only club to go 3 years, and it's not a lot of money. I mean, it's probably, as you said earlier, a reasonable gamble.
I think you may have already made the value.
Yeah, we're pretty close to it. But you know, three guaranteed years on a this kind of risk is the chance that we have to take.
I also want to lean on you for your experience as a a member of a front office in Toronto. And I would say that the current front office in Toronto has some very interesting decisions to make coming up. They've got the oldest roster in the major leagues. They've got a team that is, if not dead last, very close to dead last in terms of results this year. Is this a market where you can have a traditional rebuild, where you can really reset, or do you have to be competitive every year, or at least be selling competitiveness every year?
You know, I've thought about this, and you can be sure these are difficult conversations they're having, and internally at least. And I don't really think with as much as is involved right now, whether it's a television audience, a radio audience, the in-park attendance, all that goes with the Blue Jays these days, I don't think you can go through the Houston Astro, Chicago Cub rebuild where you go back to square one and you're prepared to lose 100, 110 games a year. I don't think you can do that. And I think the model, and I heard somebody talking about this today, was this you? Maybe it was you. But the Yankee model where, yes, you're rebuilding and you've gone back a little bit, but you haven't gone back so far where you're an embarrassment. And your fans won't accept it. So that probably is more the model, much tougher to do, obviously. But that's probably more the model that if they're thinking about rebuilding the way they're going to go about it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, I know when I talked to Brian Cashman this spring, one of the things he said, he said, please don't try to compare our rebuild to other rebuilds because, as he said, bear in mind that I'm rebuilding with a $193 million payroll. So, one of the things that the Yankees have really been able to do is they've still been able to sign Jacoby Ellsbury, players like that. They've been able to give Aroldis Chapman a contract while they're quote-unquote rebuilding. And I think to Gord's point, in Toronto right now, that's when and if that decision, that decision is going to have to be made at some point. It's regardless, it was either going to be this year or next year. I think that's probably what you're going to see. I think you're going to see ownership committed to maintaining a certain payroll. The question is going to be whether or not Mark Shapiro thinks that he can do what he wants to do with the payroll that's under that. I mean, there are times, Gord, I mean, you had to deal with the Belgian Brewers when they owned the Jays. There are times where you kind of hope you almost get a peace dividend from your ownership, don't you? In other words, I know you guys gave me 125 to rebuild this team. I've kind of done it in 110. Can I maybe keep the 15 and 2 years down the road and I'm really good? Maybe kind of rely on your good graces to use the 15 million then.
Yeah, those conversations happen quite often, and it's interesting you're having a negotiation with your owner about how you're going to spend your money. But I remember the '98 season, for instance, we signed a few free agents and. My pitch to the board of directors at that time says, look, if this doesn't work out, these guys are tradable. I know they're tradable. We can trade them in July if we have to, which in fact we did. So the first part of that year, if you recall, was ordinary. We traded all these guys and all of a sudden got to be playing pretty well in the race in September. So it's interesting the dynamics these things take on. But, this really, I think, a rebuild isn't about payroll because if anybody could have afforded a payroll, it would have been the Cubs. But they chose—that's
true.
They chose to go back to square one and start again. And collected all of the good young players that they have. And I think that's one of the differences with the Yankees and the Blue Jays at this point, is that the Yankees had a maturing farm system already in place with a number of good prospects, which they added to in trades they made last year. And this would have been a whole lot easier if this had gone to plan. And the Blue Jays are good this year. They win the World Series. And by the way, we have an old club. We need to start filtering in younger players. And that would have been a much easier sell to everyone involved. Now that there's been non-performance to this point in the season, you're right. I mean, you can be guaranteed that they're already having conversations on the what-if plan, which, because you can't wake up on July 30th and make mm-hmm. deals. You have to start laying the groundwork, whether that's scouting reports, whether that's analytic review, whatever you have there. And, you know, I think the day and age of waiting to the deadline, although it's been proven time and time again that clubs kind of gear in on that deadline, you can make deals sooner than that, and sometimes good deals. Going back to my experience in Milwaukee, Doug Melvin traded for CC Sabathia, I think in the first week of July, if I'm not mistaken. So those deals are out there and available, but you have to start that process, I would say, probably by the end of May.
One of the things, to your experience with the Blue Jays, and again, back then they were owned by Interbrew, but you had to deal with corporate ownership. How does a general manager go about approaching corporate owners when it comes to payroll? You know, like, what is the process? Do you go in front of the board and say, look, this is what I think we need to be good. This is what I think we need to be really good. This is, I mean, I can give you a team that really sucks for this much money, basically. Is that the approach you take?
Yeah, that's essentially what you do. And that's what made life with Interbrew so difficult, because you do have to have a master plan. You know, your short-term plan, your three-year plan, your five-year plan, and you're trying to build strategy based on those time frames. And when you looked at the Interbrew board of directors who, and say, well, we don't even know what we're going to do in 30 days from now, it made planning on the baseball front a little more difficult. So you needed to keep maximum flexibility. It also hurt us when it came to signing players to multi-year contracts. And for instance, Delgado ultimately signed 4 years at 17 for 68, could have signed them a couple of years before that for much less.
Mm-hmm.
For a little bit longer term too, so, you know, you pay the price with that, inability to plan. The conversations that I'm sure are going on right now between Blue Jay Way and Rogers Way is essentially that is these are the scenarios that we can look at. This is what we can do in the short term. This is what we can do. Long term, might take us 5 years to get back to World Series contention, but in the meantime, we can be competitive, we can be exciting, we can be interesting. There's still something here to sell.
Let me ask you something, and I'll tell you why I'm asking you after you answer. What kind of attendance are you guys projecting this year, the Brewers?
Well, Milwaukee's a little bit different of a market because, and it amazes me when I first moved there, because when I moved there in 2002, it was a bad ball team. And nice ballpark, but it's much more, it's and Jeff and I were talking about this earlier in relation to minor league baseball, but it's a community event. I mean, the whole tailgating issue, like on weekends, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, there's probably just as many people outside in the parking lot as are inside the stadium. But so the attendance in Milwaukee is pretty good for a city of its size and the caliber of team that's being played. So I think we budgeted this year for 2.2 million. Probably we'll do a little better than that.
Yeah.
And at our peak, 2011, when we went to the division series, or pardon me, the championship series, we were a shade over 3 million. So you know, it's never really low. Like we didn't get into the 1.2 millions like some of the other rebuilding clubs did, but there's not the mega upside either.
So you're projecting for 2.2.
Yeah.
The Toronto Blue Jays for this season have already sold 2.5. That's sold. That's before walk up, before if they go on a run or anything like that. I mean, you still live in this market. You've seen how different it's been over the last 2 years. How much does that factor into not being able to rebuild, having to stay competitive, wanting to not lose this fan base, a young fan base, by the way, and a fan base that travels very well? Some lean years could eat into that.
Well, absolutely, and that's what winning does for you, is winning in 2016, sold your tickets in 2017, even though there was some grumbling during the offseason about players you signed and didn't sign, you were still able to generate your business going forward. So, and as I understand it, and it's a much bigger deal now than it used to be, I mean, those TV rating numbers are pretty vital to the equation as well. In terms of value, it might not generate into cash in hand, but it does in terms of advertising and so on. So, and that's the trick of this. I mean, there's no question. And I'm, even though I'm a Canadian, a Torontonian, and I love being here, I'm still not sure we have baseball fans or Blue Jay fans, or right. Should I say, winning Blue Jay fans. So, mm-hmm. that is still to be answered. And if I was pressed on it, I'd have to say, it's more about the winning part of it than it is about the game itself. But, you know, it is a different crowd now. From back in the World Series years, that was a corporate crowd. That was a suit and tie crowd. That was an older crowd. I know when I go to the ballpark now, much younger, more families, more diversity. So there's a lot of positives there as well.
You got anything, Jeff?
You know, we talked a lot about how the game is skewing younger. And, you know, we've seen more and more free agents in their mid-30s. I think your Ned Colletti said when we had him on our show one time, the baseball's changed now. 37's playing like 37 because of the PED testing. 37's not playing like 27 anymore. But it's become a younger person's game. Do you see baseball kind of going through a bit of a revolution right now, not just in terms of age, but in terms of, you know, for example, how we think of the bullpen now. The Cincinnati Reds plan to have two relievers with 100 innings each. That's part of their plan. Are we going through a real revolutionary cycle right now in how people put together and manage baseball teams?
Yeah, I think what's changed, analytics has brought different ways of thinking and creative ways of thinking, and there's just not one way to solve problems. It used to be a copycat business, mm-hmm. and it is to some degree still now, but you know, clubs are being more creative, and I think one of the things that gets left out of this equation about younger major league players is the acquisition cost now is so high for your, say, your first round draft choice or your best player in Latin America. You don't want to waste those dollars with development time in the minor leagues. There's this mentality that, I just paid this kid $7 million. I have to have a return on that investment. Therefore, I'm going to fly him through the development system, and he'll contribute, and he'll, if you're the Astros from a couple of years ago, you can let the guy learn on the major league level. But in most cases, the development cost and the acquisition cost is so high for the young players now that you want to put those players in the big leagues and have them achieve at that level.
And then it also kind of, there's a carryover effect too, isn't there? Because you're going to see more and more free agents. Guys hit their first free agent contract at the age of 26, 27, the class 2 years down the road. You're going to Bryce Harper, Manny Machado. Roberto Osuna is going to be a free agent at 26, you know, if he stays healthy. And that has an economic impact as well,
yeah,
doesn't it?
And the reluctance of young players to you know, Chris Bryant already on record is saying he just thinks he'll play it out. There's a reluctance now for young players to sign those early contracts and give away some free agent years. So you're right. I mean, the free agent market in a couple of years is going to be very interesting. And this is where a club like the Yankees and to some extent the Red Sox, who have plowed money into player development, can also get you on the other side because they have the revenue to sign those top free agents as well.
For a club like yours that maybe doesn't have quite as much money to throw around as some of those clubs that you mentioned, how do you look at that upcoming free agent class, that 2018 class that's going to have so many talented players in it? How do you guys approach that?
Well, we know we have to start looking at from the bottom up. We don't work from the top down. And, you know, sometimes for whatever reason, and we saw that this year, that, you know, there are quality players that don't get what they were looking to get and aren't interested in just going anywhere for money. They want to ensure they're going to play. Chris Carter is a good example. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we signed Thames, it became, in our minds at least, that Chris Carter was too much of a one-dimensional guy. I mean, he was a home run hitter, but struck out, wasn't a great defender. And we just thought we'd get more opportunity offensively and defensively with Thames. And Chris Carter sat out there for the longest time without a job, considering going to Japan as well. Ended up with a deal with the Yankees at $3 million. And given the way it's going for him now, I don't know how much longer that's going to last either, because he's not the kind of player that can sit on the bench and be productive. This is a guy that has to get his 550 plate appearances in order to be as productive as he was.
But you're also talking about a guy who led the National League in home runs last year. Yep. Is the game valuing power differently now?
Well, you know, when you look at the free agents that kind of got cast aside last year, Trumbo, same thing, had to go back to where he was, didn't get the kind of market value that he was hoping to get either. And, you know, you can argue with whether Edwin got what he expected to get or not. So the marketplace told us that it's being valued differently, but at the same time, what is everybody talking about right now? They're talking about the show of power from an Aaron Judge. They're talking about the power Eric Thames is showing. So I think it's still a big part of the game, but I think in our case, we can't be that one-dimensional. When you're trying to maximize your payroll, you need flexibility of position has become a very big deal now in baseball, that wasn't the case. I mean, you used to have these odd stories where guys could play four or five positions. That's if you look at a lot of the rosters in the National League now, there's multiple guys that can do that, play in different roles and different positions and, you know, different ways to get on base. This is a guy that'll take a walk. He'll get his base hits and he'll hit doubles. He's not going to hit home runs. Analytics tells us that that's more favorable.
You mentioned Latin America earlier. I know you've been down to the Dominican recently. You're looking at a complex down there. And, you know, with some of the spending limits that are going to come through in the new CBA, maybe that's an area where smaller market teams can have an advantage against some of the bigger market ones, no?
In theory, yes.
In theory. What happens in practice?
Well, it's still not to the degree it used to be. It's still the Wild West there. There's still a lot of unusual activity. You know, you're permitted. I'll just give you this small example. You're permitted to talk and sign players that are 16 years of age, will reach their 17th birthday sometime after July 2nd. And in technical ways, they aren't entitled to sign until that date, July 2nd. But there's all kinds of conversations that go on ahead of time. In fact, you probably get a list right now of who signed with who, and here we are in early May.
Right.
But not only is that going on, there's conversations for July 2nd of 2018 already going on. So, you know, I'm not sure it will ever truly be a level playing field. It's much better than it was, but it's still not what you want it to be.
In your opinion, will we ever see an international draft, or is that not going to happen?
Well, it should, and I know there was I wish I could understand why the players were so adamantly against it the last time, the Latin American players. I don't think that they really understood necessarily that this could also be a benefit, because yeah, there's a few players like a young Vladimir Guerrero who got $4 million, but by and large, players were signing for $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. Those guys getting the headlines were the exceptions. Under a draft, the floor will be lifted. The top might come down a little, but the overall amount of money being spent probably will increase.
Yeah, no, I same thing. I've never understood why universal draft wouldn't be in effect, and I've never understood why Latin American players would be against it. It just makes no sense to me.
No, and you know, people for the longest time would say it's an administrative nightmare, which, you know, there was a Latin American draft, and I'm going to say this was like about 1986 or 7. There was so much corruption going on, the commissioner said, we're closing down. Nobody can sign any players. And that went on for about 6 months, and then they said, okay, we're going to reopen the market by having a draft, which in theory sounded good, but you know, at the end of the day, the same guy got drafted three times under three different names by three different clubs, and it became a bit of an administrative nightmare. But you can even get over that because now you just have the players register. Mm-hmm. Anybody wants to be drafted, you register. And once you're registered, then it's easy to sort out from that point of view.
Does anyone have a question for Mr. Ash or Mr. Blair? Or my friend is approaching the microphone.
Thank you. Intuition versus analytics. Where do you put Gibby?
Well, I don't know him like these two guys do, so they're probably better to answer that question. My intuition tells me that he's an intuition guy to a great extent. And you know, I'm clearly of the age that I grew up in this game under the old school. But Pat Gillick was always a visionary. He was a guy ahead of his time. And while he didn't call it analytics, there certainly was a tinge of that to what he did in terms of making decisions. So there's nothing wrong with more information and better information to help you make a decision. But I can tell you all of his best decisions were intuition with the background of having that information behind him. And that's the way it should work now. I mean, these clubs that go solely on numbers, I think that's starting to change a little bit. Theo Epstein talks about this all the time. It has to be a blend of both to make it work, truly make it work. But I would say, Arden or Jeff, you should answer that. But I think he's an intuition guy myself.
Yeah, I think he, it's funny because I asked Ross Atkins this last year, and about the discussions he has with Gibby and about, you know, how Gibby will set a lineup. And he said, you'd be surprised at how much Gibbons, you know, will listen to the analytical argument and will process it and will take it into account. But yeah, by and large, he is, once the game starts, he's very much an intuition guy. And I think maybe it seems to me there's two aspects when it comes to managing, setting the lineup and the game itself. And I think a lot of managers rely on analytics when it comes to setting the lineup a lot of times, Gore. But when the actual game starts, I mean, unless there's a huge, you know, statistical evidence that says this guy hits 600 against this pitcher and 50 at bats, you might want to pinch hit that guy. But if that's not the case, I think once the game starts, a lot of times it is intuition.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we've seen a lot of here lately is it used to be old school, used to be your best hitter should hit third.
Right.
Now we've seen that creep up to the second spot now in a lot of situations. So, you know, the managers, and this has been going on now long enough in terms of the analytics, this is not new anymore. It's been around long enough that the managers that tell the stat geek to get the hell out of his office, that doesn't happen anymore. I mean, there are conversations, legitimate conversations. The best ones are a give and take both ways. And I think you're right. Once the game starts, it's a little bit different. And you don't have time, quite frankly, when you're thinking baseball is a slow-moving game, but it isn't for those that are trying to influence its outcome. So they're always thinking, and they don't have time necessarily to go through all of the detail, which, you know, it's interesting that a couple of years ago, iPads were permitted in the dugout to process a lot of this. I don't see them.
No, you don't see them.
No, not very often. So,
they're still using the old-fashioned binders. So, yeah. You know, I don't know what happened there, but that didn't seem to resonate with the coaches at all.
Habits are hard to change, you know, and a lot of these guys are just there. That's the way they do it, and they're used to it, and they know a binder's not going to crash or run out of batteries.
You know, one of the things when Ned Yost managed the Brewers, and we had the luxury of not. I mean, you always want to win a game, but, you know, we knew we weren't going to make the playoffs, so we did a lot of experimenting, and we tried to match our lineup with fly ball and ground ball. If it was their ground ball pitcher, we wanted fly ball hitters and vice versa, and we did a lot of that. You know, Russell Branyon came to us because he was a tremendous fly ball hitter, obviously with his power, and when you matched him up against a noted ground ball pitcher, you know, he had tremendous results. So we had a lot of fun with that, too.
I was going to ask you, you know, you talk about setting a lineup like that. There was, and I don't know, maybe some of you read this article. It was in FanGraphs. I think it was about a week ago. But the discussion was about outfield shifts, as opposed to when we think of shifts, we quite often, obviously, we talk about infield shifts. They're talking about how teams like the Houston Astros are pretty aggressive with their outfield shifts, and how A.J. Hinch, their manager, was saying, you know, if we've got an extreme fly ball pitcher and there's an extreme fly ball hitter at the plate, maybe we need a fourth outfielder instead of having guys around the infield. I mean, if the chances are the ball's going to be hit in the air, maybe we put two guys in the gap. Now, he's just blue sky. He's not. It's a far cry between talking about that to reporters and actually doing it in the game. But can you see something like that happening?
Oh, absolutely. And there's, you know, with StatCast and more information that you have in terms of defensive metrics, you're going to see more of that, I believe. Mm-hmm. But you saw it the other day, Victor Martinez bunted because they shipped. Well, you know, if he wants to take first base instead of hitting a double or a home run, I'm happy. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously you want to get him out, but chances are he's going to get on base. Best to give him a single than allow him to drive in a run or hit a home run. So I think you're going to see more of that. One of the disconnects in all of this, and again, the Brewers were one of the first clubs to what we called radical shifting back in the early 2000s. And we started to get away from it because the pitchers weren't on board.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is a discussion topic that's part of player development. Okay, pitcher, are we defending to your strengths or are we defending to the hitter's weakness? And that's a debate that rages on all the time. And the pitchers need to get on board with what you're trying to do defensively as well.
I think StatCast is really going to change the defensive evaluation, because I'd be curious to know if you agree with this, but I hear some people in the game talking about how the evaluating defense is kind of an imperfect science at, you know, to this point, and StatCast are getting all this data that's really going to change things in a big way. Correct?
Absolutely. Yeah? I mean, it's been interesting though as this has evolved, because the clubs that were early advocates of shifting, their infielders, particularly getting away from the outfield at a moment, would get extra credit for defensive metrics because it wasn't taken into account where they started. Now with StatCast, you can do that. So what looked on paper to be an infielder moving to his right 15 feet after the shift ended up only being 5 feet, and it's now measurable where before it was not.
Anybody else got a question in the front row here?
Is clearly the road that the Cubs took. I mean, and they very candidly talk about the fact that there's just too much risk in pitching. They'd rather take young hitters where there's less risk, more probable upside, and they'll find their pitching in other ways. So when you look at Schwarber and Bryant, and they traded for Rizzo, he was in a draft. But, you know, the idea to collect the young hitters and then find your pitching elsewhere is the way to go. But I can tell you, I mean, there are all kinds of draft stories. And if we had some scouts here, they'd all manufacture their own version of history, which is one of the greatest things that's happened. You know, years ago, you'd sit in a draft room, something like this, and your scouts would be there. And you'd go through, there'd be a board like this, and the names would be on the board. And then as soon as the draft is over, the scout would say, I had that guy third on the list. Well, no one ever had any documentation to say whether that was right or not.
Right.
Well, now it's all done electronically, so you have the list all the time. So the scouts can't come in the June 15th edition of Baseball America and say, I had this guy third on the list, and you can say, well, no, you didn't. He was 37th on your list. And, you know, there are examples of, there's guys that have gone in the first round that scouts haven't even turned in. That is, didn't like something about the guy. So it's a real inexact science. It's a real crapshoot. It's a roll of the dice, whatever you want to call it. And there, it's I think because of analytics and decision-making discipline. That's probably the biggest thing I've seen through the years is that, you know, let's talk about Joe Smith here. And Joe Smith, we're going to talk about his unbelievable makeup and his character, strength of character, and don't talk anything about his playing ability. And then we'll go over here to Frank Jones, and we'll knock him down because even though he's a great athlete and has tremendous results, we don't like his character. So there was an inexact science. And you know, my theory with our people in Milwaukee is they usually rank about 250 players. They'll see up to 500, but they usually rank about 250 players. I think you should be able to rank those players based on your decision-making criteria automatically. They're all assessed a value, and you could rank them automatically. Where the art comes into it is, okay, we've got this list. Now we're going to amend that list based, going back to this question here before, on some intuition, some experience.
When I see Aaron Judge, you know, I was looking back at Carlos Delgado's first full season. Carlos Delgado came out, I think he had 8 home runs in his first 10 games or something like that.
Trying to play left field, too.
What tells you when a guy is going to be Carlos Delgado and not Kevin Moss? You know what I mean? Like a guy who's going to, a big slugger who's going to have a long career, as opposed to a guy who's going to hit the all-star break with 20 home runs and finish his major league career with 27.
I think the willingness to make adjustments.
Okay.
Every player should be able to make an adjustment. A coach should be able to give a mechanical suggestion to make that adjustment. But some players are just stubborn. They just will not. I just hit 10 home runs this month doing it my way. Why will I switch? Well, you need to switch because just like Eric Thames is going to find out now, that the league wasn't paying any attention to him before. You can bet they are now. They're going through their scouting reports. So they're making adjustments, and he in turn will have to make adjustments. And that was what was one of Delgado's greatest qualities. He was a very smart guy. Mm. He understood his swing. He understood what the other team was trying to do to him, and he made those necessary adjustments. And I had to go back to the minor leagues for a little bit just to kind of get his footing back. But, you know, guys like Kevin Moss, tremendous ability, but just won't make those adjustments. And Judge went through this a little bit last year. Mm-hmm. He had a so-so minor. He went to the fall league in the fall of, losing track of my years, 15, I guess. Yeah. And, you know, he was the talk of the league. Scouts all loved him. Came out in 16, so-so minor league season. Played erratically at the big league level, so-so there too. And obviously has blossomed this year. But, you know, he's such an immense talent physically. I think that's probably what helps him all the best. But from here on, it's going to be about the adjustments he's able to make.
Do you think we realized how good a player Carlos Delgado was? You know, this is a guy who didn't last in the Hall of Fame ballot. I mean, I covered the guy, and he went through the end of his career where I think a lot of people got tired, frankly, of hearing, is Carlos Delgado going to be traded? Is he going to re-sign? So you look at this guy's numbers, and you look at what he did, and it just seems to me that he never gets, A, the respect, or even, B, the love that he deserved in the city.
No, I will readily admit he was one of my favorites. He was a great guy to talk to, and not just about baseball, but, you know, just about everyday life, fully engaged in the city and his role as being a part of this city and in terms of charitable events and so on and so forth, a very organized guy. Two guys in my, and this doesn't really mean anything other than it impressed me, but two guys that stood out. You know, it became your job as a GM when no one else in the organization could get this player to do a charitable event.
Right.
Can you talk to him, please?
Right.
Which I really never liked doing, but I did it on occasion. And two guys stood out. Roger Clemens. Roger, we need you on June 14th to do this. And right away, okay, June 13th, I'm doing that. June 15th, I'm doing that. Yes, I can do that. He knew what he was doing. He had a handle on what he was doing. It wasn't, you know, and Carlos was much the same way. So getting back to your question, yes, he was underappreciated. I was amazed how quickly he fell off the Hall of Fame ballot.
I would have thought, I'm not saying he's a Hall of Famer, but I would have thought he would have gotten a little more consideration than that. But I think what hurt him probably is he was not a great defender.
Right.
And that probably, he was seen as probably a typical American League DH type guy.
Who else got a question? I see a hand right there.
So I think the most significant transaction between the Blue Jays and the Milwaukee Brewers is Marco Estrada for Adam Lind. We know how that's played out, but I'm interested in what the Brewers' perception of that trade was at the time. I know a lot of us, I think Jeff included, didn't think that was a good trade from Toronto's perspective at the time.
I honestly don't think I cared either way.
I thought they were getting rid of a guy
who, you know, that the guy that they could find better than Adam Lind for a guy who was going to give up a lot of fly balls at the Rogers Center.
I recall that. But I'm wondering what Milwaukee's perspective of that trade was at the time. I know we know how it's played out, but what that was.
And that's one of the great things about what you're asking here, because there's a lot of looking back in baseball and saying, well, what if? And one of the chief roles of analytics in my mind is the projection system. It's about what's going to happen. We can all look back and know what happened. We want to know what's going to happen. And that's one of the biggest roles I think analytics can take on is the projection systems that clubs have in place. But going to that particular trade, it was actually pretty simple. We had no first baseman. A fielder had gone. We had a big hole there. We didn't want to pay Marco going forward. He was on, you know, a couple of years from free agency. And Jeff's right. He was a fly ball pitcher. And we had our ballpark is not suited to fly ball pitchers. And to his credit, he talking about adjustments, he's, you know, we would see the Marco you're seeing here on a regular basis, we would see for an inning here, an inning there, a game here, a game there, was never consistent. And I think that's what he's been able to do, is be consistent, keep the ball in the ballpark. And, you know, people talk about the role the cutter has played for him now. But, you know, when I see him pitch, and what's amazing to me, especially with hitters that know him, say hitters that were in the National League and have come over to the American League, they know the changeup's coming, and they still can't touch it. That's how good it is. And that's really what separates him from what he was in the past. He could not do that consistently.
He's had a pretty dramatic mentality change here in Toronto as well. He learned from Mark Burley and David Price especially that, you know, right now he'll throw whatever the catcher puts down. Whatever the finger is, that's the pitch that's coming. He doesn't labor as much on the mound. You don't see him thinking as much on the mound, whereas I think in Milwaukee you could really see the gears turning.
Well, this is another age-old argument among scouts. They get a bunch of scouts in a room, and they'll throw this one out, and then they'll argue for the next hour, which comes first, success or confidence. And I believe it's different for different people, but clearly in Marco's case, his success allowed him to become confident, because he was not a confident pitcher when he was in Milwaukee. He doubted himself all the time. So I think now that's a much different part of his repertoire as well. He believes in him. He believes in himself and what he can do.
And last one on that, the Blue Jays were really motivated to move Adam Lind. How aware were you guys of that the Blue Jays were looking to move this player?
No, we knew that, and we knew there had been some incidents, so to speak, of that previous year. But, you know, our reports were that he was an okay guy, a little bit different, which we found out. But, you know, he the biggest thing for us was the injury factor, the bad back. And he did not miss a game for us. I mean, he played on a regular basis. He did a credible job. We enjoyed what he did for us. But, again, it just became a situation where you're not going to retain those kind of guys that are going to make too much money, and you had to move on from that as well.
Anyone else, guys? I see a hand back here, and I got you next. No, not like the last one, eh? Not like the last one.
Right. Okay. So in this market, we hear a lot about investment into high performance and how the Blue Jays put a lot of money into giving their players the best they can and have almost individual set routines and everything like that. How does a team like Milwaukee invest into high performance, and with their financial, you know, that kind of thing, approach that in that side?
This is going to sound like a criticism, but it isn't. Every club has high performance now. This is not something the Blue Jays invented. They give it a lot more attention, perhaps, and certainly talk about it a lot more than other clubs. But the Brewers have been doing this for quite a while. We don't have the manpower that apparently they've added here in Toronto, but the mentality of the total approach, whether that's nutrition, whether that's strength and conditioning, whether that's massage therapy, whether that's injury prevention.
Psychology.
In fact, I'll do some boasting. First club that had a full-time psych coach, traveled with the team, had an office at the ballpark, young guy. So I always viewed that as very, very important. And if it wasn't necessarily for the player, it was for the coach to help the player understand the player, how to reach the player. So I say most clubs are doing it. The biggest change in all of this, and the one thing you touched on, is the, okay, all pitchers, let's go out and we're all going to throw long toss 100 feet. Then we're going to take two steps back and do it again. Then we're going to take three steps back and do it again. That doesn't happen anymore. Everybody is individualized in terms of their program and their approach, because what works for Jeff isn't going to work for Arden and so on. So there's a unique and individual approach which takes manpower. The old days of having the trainer kind of slash equipment guy, that doesn't happen anymore. Highly trained, skilled individuals taking on those strength and conditioning roles. Trainers are all certified now and have been now for, I guess, a couple of CBAs. But, you know, back 20 years ago, you didn't even have to be certified to be a trainer. And if you found yourself in the right situation. But that's all changed now, and everybody has to be certified. So the one criticism the Blue Jays get right now that they don't deserve is, okay, how come we have so many injuries when you just added this this high performance? The high performance isn't going to pay dividends now. It's for 5 years from now as the young players move through and know how to properly prepare themselves.
Before you go, Jeff, just to that point, the Blue Jays have a postural specialist. That's his title, postural specialist.
And what that is, believe it or not, and we were doing that in Milwaukee as well, is when the players show up for spring training, you take their photo.
Yeah.
And then that photo is analyzed, and believe it or not, depending on how they are carrying their frame, the doctor or the specialist can identify areas of weakness that are potential injury risks, and you address them right away.
I was going to just kind of spin off that a little bit. Your experience as a general manager and as a baseball executive, the situation in New York where you have a pitcher in Noah Syndergaard declined to take an MRI, ends up getting hurt, understandably, we're led to believe an injury not related to what that MRI was supposedly going to look at. I mean, that's got to be a nightmare scenario for a general manager, isn't it? Because you've kind of got your medical people, and you got the player. And I think it was Sandy Alderson who said, guys, I can't put him in the MRI machine. I mean, I just can't pick him up, throw him in, and turn it on. How do you balance that? You know, the input of your medical staff versus the player just saying, I'm going out to pitch. I don't care what you guys say.
Yeah, and that shouldn't happen. I think, was it in the player's best interest to turn that down. But it seems like all the drama happens with the Mets, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But in any event, yes. I think what's important is that your team physician, and this may be one of the issues with the Mets, your team physician, and I know in Milwaukee, and it was the case when I was here in Toronto, your team physician is around the players all the time. There's a relationship there. Your club officials, whoever's in charge of the medical staff, when I was in Milwaukee as the assistant, that was my role. That wasn't something that Doug got involved in. We were talking with the players all the time. And under the collective bargaining agreement, the players have the right to a second opinion. And sometimes that second opinion process gets a little nasty. But you don't often hear where a player refuses the test. Now, there are players that are dead set against having an MRI just from a fear factor point of view. I know in my experience, we've had a couple of players had to be knocked out to take it.
Yeah.
Just because it's, if you've experienced it, it's all very claustrophobic. But if you have the right relationship, or you can call on the agent that you have a good relationship, all this was all in the player's best interest. There was nothing negative to this at all. So I don't understand how it got to that point. I especially don't understand how he came back to pitch 4 days later after that incident. So, and the injury he has right now, significant. I mean, they're downplaying it, so significant. If it's a torn lat muscle, that's going to be a while.
Over here.
I thought the previous guy that asked about the trade question was going to bring up the Markham for Laurie trade as the most popular one. I'd be curious to hear from Gord first and Arden and Jeff after about what they saw with their intuition for Brett Laurie and maybe the psychological breakdown of that player and where he's ended up now.
Well, he was a first-round draft choice for us, a prolific physical talent, but this guy was a nut. There's no other way around it. I mean, he was
worse than Brad Fulmer.
Worse than Brad Fulmer, okay. Because Brad wasn't malicious.
No, that's true.
Brett was malicious, and by that I mean he'd get into tangles with his teammates, and it was whatever team, minor league team he was on, it was ugly. So I'll share you a little story. Part of my responsibility each year, towards the end of the year, I would meet with AA and AAA. We did our minor league system a little differently. The AA and AAA team was managed out of the Milwaukee office, and the other clubs, the A clubs and rookie clubs, were managed by the player development guys. So I would go into our AA affiliate at the end of the year, and I'd have a meeting with each player. If it was a pitcher, the pitching coach would be there. If it was a hitter, the hitting coach would be there, and we'd discuss what he had accomplished that year, what the off-season goals were, and what we wanted to see happen next year. So when we talked to Laurie was playing second base at the time. We wanted to convert him to center field. And we said, you're going to go to the fall league this year. You're going to play center field. And there's about 3 weeks left in the season when we've had this meeting. And, you know, he was got up out of the meeting very happy, very appreciative, liked the idea. So that night, he obviously went home and talked to somebody, or his agent, his father, whoever had influence on him. Came back the next day while I was having another meeting with, in fact, the current center fielder. Didn't knock on the door, just barged his way in and said, I want to play center field, and I want to play it now, and I'm way better than he is. I mean, what do you do with that guy? In any event, there was just too many of those kind of incidents where we were going to move him. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of who to, and for what return. And again, there was a debate in our room. I was not against trading him, obviously, because this was a fuse that was about to ignite. I would have liked to have gotten his equal, though, in terms of service. So instead of getting a pitcher that was a couple of years from free agency, who, granted, got us to the postseason that year. Did very, very well for us. But I think for our long-term interests, it would have been better to get the equivalent in a young pitcher.
I think that may have been a situation, too, where you had an organization in the Blue Jays who wanted Brett Laurie. I mean, I don't know if this is just BS, but the story was if you guys didn't take Brett Laurie, the Jays were going to take him. I think you took him with the pick before, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true. Yep.
So he's a guy that the Jays player development people had an interest in initially. And I'm led to believe it wasn't just because he was Canadian. They liked some of the things they saw. I mean, I remember when that trade was made. I think most of us thought it was a good trade because the Jays had become kind of staid. And I know when you talk to people around the team, the stuff that you talked about, Gord, they kind of viewed that as a bit of a positive. I mean, they wanted a guy who was a bit of an ass, to be honest, because they thought they'd gotten a little comfortable. And I also think, for a variety of reasons, Sean Markham had kind of worn out his welcome or overstayed his welcome in Toronto.
He was no peach either,
as well.
When
no.
it comes to clubhouse.
But yeah, in terms of the deal itself, at the time, I thought the deal made sense, but it's also because the Blue Jays have had an issue now for, God, going back to even I guess just maybe JP's second or third year, they just haven't done a good job of developing position players. And they've always needed to go out and get position players. I mean, you look at this organization, you look at the starting lineup right now. Kevin Pillar is an organizational guy. Ryan Goins, he's an organizational guy. But, you know, he's a bench guy. Devin Travis, somebody else's guy.
Tigers.
They haven't done a very good job of putting position players on the field. So they've been forced to trade for guys. And a guy like Brett Laurie fit, you know, filled a need that they had at that time.
This was also a time in Alex Anthopoulos' 10 years, Blue Jays GM, and other members of that front office where they weren't putting as much weight on makeup.
Yeah.
So they took on,
He's admitted that. He said, hey, we brought in some guys that we should not have brought in.
He took on Yunel Escobar at that time, Colby Rasmus at that time, Brett Laurie, players who had, you know, definite red flags from a makeup standpoint.
Anthony Ghost is another one,
exactly.
And there's, I'm kind of on the middle on this one because I believe you have to collect the best physical talent you can.
Yes.
And that falls in a different bucket to me than building your team. They're different. You don't want those kind of players necessarily on your team, but you want them in your organization because they hold value that you can pass on to someone else.
And we saw Brett Laurie. I would say they probably got value in that deal.
And when you're looking at a guy like Brett Laurie, you mentioned moving him to center field. This is a guy who also caught in his minor league career, broke in as a third baseman, played second. I mean, he is an unbelievable physical talent. He was probably the best athlete on some of those Blue Jays teams when he was on them. But like Gord said, it's just not a guy you want in your clubhouse.
Yeah.
Anybody else have one last final question before I can't even see if there's a one, two. You already asked one, so let's go with my friend at the bar there.
I was just wondering if there's any particular team that you remember from your career that you have like kind of fond memories for, or like you felt really proud of their success. Is there anything that stands out?
Yeah, but the when I wear my World Series rings, which isn't that often, I always wear the 93 ring because it's the team I felt I had more to do with. You know, Pat was very good to me. Obviously, 92 was a success all the way around, and I think in 93 he kind of turned a lot of the day-to-day responsibilities over to myself and allowed me to do a lot of the things that a joint general manager might have done. I was always very thankful for that. So that particular team probably I felt a little more connected to. I think the 98 team was an interesting team as well. You know, if we had a closer probably in the last month, we might have got there, but you know, we didn't, and we were trying to close with a failed starter that kind of melted down, and I think that might have been the beginning of our hatred for the Tropicana Field too, because that was a disastrous September trip that year.
That's a horrible September trip.
But those two stand out to me. But you know, all of it, with the exception probably the strike year. The strike year was tough. And by far, although it was my first year as the GM, by far the worst experience was the replacement camp. I mean, that was not pleasant at all, especially if you recall back then, if the strike had gone on, we wouldn't even played games in Toronto. We would have had to stay in Florida and played our games there because of the labor laws here in Ontario. So nobody was happier to see that strike settled than I was.
All right, last one. It's my guy. If you still have it.
So as a follow-up to the last bit about taking players in the minor leagues and changing their roles within the system, I'm just really interested when you started talking about how you altered Brett Laurie's future by moving him around, or he determined how he was doing it. How does that work within an organization where you take a player, you're a catcher, now you're a third baseman, or you're a center fielder? Like I just found that fascinating. I wanted to hear a little more.
Not back then.
Not in that necessary situation, in general.
Not back then necessarily, but now that is part of development. There are players that are identified as multi-positional players, and they're developed that way. So you can play second, short, third, left field, probably center field, and they're developed that way, so they have the experience at that area because there's value placed on multi-positional players. In Laurie's particular case, he played second base like a linebacker. I mean, he we needed to get him out of there, but we wanted to put him in the outfield and maintain his ability to run and keep his athleticism, because it was just too physically demanding. He made the position too physically demanding, because you know he liked the guys running into him, I think.
He was sad when the rules were changed last year. That wasn't any good.
You can also create a bit of value in a young player if you have him playing up the middle as well, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a big deal now about middle infielders being able to play on both sides of the bag, but that's not new either. I mean, going back in Blue Jay history, I mean, we had a number of good middle infielders. We had Cesar Asturias, Michael Young.
Yeah.
In fact, they were on the same team, and the way the director of development set it up is, okay, 5 days shortstop, 5 days second base, and then flip it over. So they both played an equal number of times. We had Orlando Hudson, we had Felipe Lopez, as I said. So Brett Abernathy, a guy that never made it, but if you were to ask scouts from a perspective point of view, he was the guy they liked the best. But, you know, he played a little bit in the big leagues with Tampa. But so you just try and maximize those guys. And we had the same logjam at first base, although – you know, we talked earlier about Delgado having to play left field, wanted his bat in the lineup, but we had other first basemen that we needed to play as well. So, you know, in the American League, you're fortunate with the DH. In the National League, obviously, you don't have that.
That's Gord Ash. That's Jeff Blair. Give him a round of applause.
Thank you.
Great questions. Thank you. HomestandSports.com. Thanks to Mills Street. Thanks to This Ain't Hollywood. See you later.